So this is Julia Nyhan, and it is the 17th of October, and it is 6 p.m. London time, and it's 12 around 12 o'clock midday in Wisconsin, and I'm interviewing Professor John J. Nitti Emeritus for the Hidden Histories Project. So the first question that I want to ask, please, is about your earliest memories of encountering computing technology.
Okay. Well, I'm it's a very vivid memory because it really was the pivotal point in my approaching lexicography using as much information technology as possible. And of course, we're talking about a long time ago. We're talking about the very late 60s in 1970, and my first significant grant, which if I remember correctly, was for like $242,000 from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I was still a graduate student, in fact, at the time. I developed that proposal, and we did get the funding for it. But prior to that time, I had it's an odd sort of a thing because I know one of your questions here is where is it? Where are we here? Which people particularly influenced you and how, and with regard to the technology aspect, not obviously not to Hispanism, which is my field, medieval Hispanism. But the two are linked because my first contact with computer technology, with an eye toward employing it and applying it to my research, occurred when one of my fellow graduate students actually, not one of the best graduate students, but I owe him this. He said to me one day, "I'm looking for a thesis topic." He said, "Now, what I really want to do is to generate a concordance of a large Spanish text or medieval Spanish text, a transcription that I'll do." And he said, "And I heard that our campus computing facility, which at the time, of course, was mainframe based, as most, if not all, were. There were, of course, mini computers, but there were no microcomputers at that time. He said, I understand that they've brought a concordancing program and brought it up on the UNIVAC, which was the big campus mainframe at the University of Wisconsin at the time." And he said, "You're interested in things technical." He said, "Would you do me a favor and check it out?" And I said, "Okay." So I went over there to the computer center and started talking to people, and they gave me a few dollars worth of credit so I could actually run a sample concordance of the thing. Now, we're talking really primitive stuff. I mean, it produced a concordance, but of course, these were the days when you were lucky if you had an IBM system, if your campus had an IBM system, then you could use extended ASCII, EBCDIC, and you could get upper and lowercase characters. But if you didn't, you were simply lost because all they could produce and print was lowercase characters. And of course, the input device was a big disappointment to me to begin with when I discovered that at that time, we're talking about a very large campus computing facility at the University of Wisconsin, which is a camp, is a campus of some size. We have traditionally had 45,000 students at this campus from year to year. And the University of Wisconsin-Madison, of course, is in fact the flagship campus of the University of Wisconsin University system. The input device, of course, that they pointed to was a key punch device, a key punch machine. And I thinking, what? I have to punch cards to do this stuff. And of course, they only had uppercase letters, so that was it. So you had to punch all these cards and transcribe all these texts in uppercase. Well, I took my colleague over there, the fellow who wanted to do this, and I got him started, and eventually he did. We were both working on our dissertation simultaneously, and he eventually actually did produce a concordance, and he submitted that as an introduction with that for his doctoral dissertation. But I was doing other stuff. I was already working for my mentor, Lloyd Kasten, who died at the age of 94, and he was still going strong 3 months up until his death. He was still working on the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language with me, at that point. And he took to the idea right up front. At the time, he was already in his late 70s, and he said, "Let's do this. You want? Don't you? Don't? Wouldn't you like to get into this computer thing more deeply and see if we can't computerize, as we say, computerize the old Spanish dictionary project?" And I said, "I sure would." He said, "We don't have any money to do it." He said, "Well, we'll start out with some." He was a very frugal man, a single man. He had apparently a sizable savings account, and so he was totally willing to put up for an individual pretty large sums of money so that I could start playing around with computers. So it was probably Lloyd Kasten who was more influential in giving me an opportunity to get my feet wet, or get both our feet wet, as it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to give credit to that one graduate student. The poor guy died young. He became a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, the smaller campus, and he died in his 40s, which is a tragedy. But in any case, that's how I got started in all of this.
So when you sort of headed over to the computer center and got some credit, were you one of the few people, humanities people, who had turned up there? Did they think
I was the only one, to my knowledge? That's not true. There was a professor of English who, in fact, went before I in this. Historical sequence, and I can't remember his name, quite frankly. He and I didn't have much contact at all. He was working on the Dictionary of Old English, and he was already into the technology such as it was, more deeply than I. But as the years passed, he left the University of Wisconsin. And we had no further contact. But as the years passed, I got not only interested in our developing software, ad hoc software, to do just what we wanted to do, what I wanted to do for the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language, but more importantly, to develop, believe this or not, to develop hardware, not ourselves physically, although I did end up actually building these in the early years. Before there were much in the way of microcomputers, you had Radio Shack had not yet released its TRS-80. Apple was on the verge of releasing their first Apple, which wasn't very powerful at all and couldn't even do what I wanted to do. But in addition to that, IBM had not yet released its PC, which was obviously seminal in the development, subsequent development, certainly of Microsoft and Bill Gates' fortune. In any case, I started looking right from the very outset. The campus computer, the mainframe, which we were obliged to use. I hesitate to use the word compelled, but we were obliged to use it because it was in their interest, since the university was renting this thing from UNIVAC at great expense. They wanted to generate as many users as possible, and up to that point, the lion's share, and even afterwards, the lion's share of users, of course, were scientific as opposed to humanities people. Things changed a little bit as things went on, as the years went on, but what happened with the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language project was, once we got some substantive funding, although Lloyd Kasten continued to contribute out of his own pockets, so that I could indulge my fancies and whims with hardware devices, testing out devices, and I'll mention some to you in a bit. It became patently clear to me that our having to use the campus UNIVAC of the University of Wisconsin for our processing was in fact what we call today a ripoff. It was outrageously priced. I'll give you an example. Of course, a project such as ours, which presupposed that we were going to be transcribing from the original manuscripts or photographic reproductions of the original manuscripts, required a number of things. Number one, that I develop a technique for transcribing, that is, a manual of transcription for the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language, an encoding text, if you will, And I was given to understand that I was one of the earliest ones around to actually develop such a thing. In order to publish it, and anticipating the publication of large quantities of data, Lloyd Kasten and I simultaneously created a nonprofit publishing house called the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies. Now, here I'll bring back the name John O'Neill, my Irish student, because once the director of the Hispanic Society of America was a very close personal friend of mine, and he asked me, have you gotten a good PhD who could be my replacement for my departing curator of rare books and manuscripts? And I said, I sure do. He's an Irishman, if you don't discriminate against the Irish. And I knew Ted, he chuckled, and Ted Beardsley he's dead. He just died, in fact, a few months ago. Ted Beardsley was the then director of the Hispanic Society of America and had been for 40 years. Ted said, well, he's coming to Madison. He said he wanted to meet this boy. So he did, and he met him, and he liked him as much as I liked him. And he hired him on the spot to be the curator of rare books and manuscripts. Now, this has been, 15 years ago? He's still there as curator, but they've made him, in addition to curator of manuscripts and rare books, they've made him the head librarian of the Hispanic Society of America. In any case, if I start to wander,
you're fine yet.
Okay. We decided, Lloyd Kasten and I decided that anticipating the production of large quantities of data and wanting to publish it, even in intermediate forms, that is, to get out, to disseminate as soon as possible, for instance, the large number of texts that we were transcribing from the original manuscripts or from photocopies of the originals, we wanted to distribute them to the world. So we looked around for technology, another technology. What would it be that we could marry to the fact that we were capturing all these keystrokes in a computer readable form? And the then technology for mass dissemination of data was really, there weren't any DVDs or CDs, was in fact what's called computer output on microform or microfiche in this case. We were going to miniaturize all these thousands of pages of transcription and or concordances that we were generating, not with that old concordance program. I'll tell you what we did as part of the software, our own software development, in a bit. But we knew we had to somehow or other, because we weren't going to be able to publish this stuff, which was fairly esoteric. I mean, you're relatively few people in the world who are interested or are going to pay a fortune, if that's what you're going to have to charge, just to recoup expenses of all this material. So we said we have to distribute this in a medium that we can afford to distribute for pennies, literally pennies on the dollar. And what was that medium? It was computer output on microfiche. So we worked a contract with a commercial service bureau in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I went up there a number of times, and we got it all coordinated, and we actually did publish and disseminate for years, the data that we were generating, both textual transcriptions and corresponding concordances with frequency counts and all that typical stuff that you get with concordancing schemes. And we were able to sell it through this new publishing house we created, the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies. You may want to go online to the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies. John O'Neill in New York has created a website, and he actually sells all the publications out of that website. John has kept the Hispanic Seminary going.
I took a look at it actually just before we talked.
Did you?
Yeah.
How did you get wind of that, of the website?
Well, I'm sort of, careful to research as much as I can about whoever I see here in advance.
So you actually went on the website, and the one that's got the old seal, there's a seal, a medieval seal on it.
Yeah, it's a lovely website, I have to say.
Yeah, my sister, who was an artist, drew that seal for us.
Oh, really?
And it's been is inspired by seals of the 13th century, for the kingdom of Alfonso the Wise, who is in fact the king that we generated the first the largest database for his manuscripts, because they, so many of the manuscripts that Alfonso had produced for him and that we assume he held in his own hands have survived, believe it or not. And we were able to use photostatic reproductions or microfilm of those manuscripts to create the dictionary of King Alfonso, of the what we call the Castilian prose of Alfonso the Wise, he was called. Well, that's great. I know that you actually got to see that. Yeah, it's John O'Neill who's keeping that operation going as a sidelight on his own time. He operates it out of the Hispanic Society of America now. And in fact, all of the books, he continues to publish books, as a matter of fact, in the field, and all of the books continue to bear the seal stamped in gold on the hardcover, and all the books we published. And the only difference is that it now says publication location. It doesn't say Madison, Wisconsin, and then the date of publication, it says New York, because it's coming out of the Hispanic. Technically, the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies is a subsidiary of the Hispanic Society of America. So that's how that ended up. But I had it all legally transferred, had lawyers get involved and transferred the whole affair when I retired to John O'Neill. Mm. Knowing that he would keep it going.
Can I just, there's just one question that I want to go back and ask. So the chap who died young, who sort of,
yes.
You know, who mentioned to you that there was the computer
right.
center and you went
right.
over to take a look and, and so do I understand correctly that it was in that, through that, the time that you got to spend in the computer center, that was really what then inspired you to involve computational technology in your...
Yes, but I quickly learned that the state of that technology as applicable to our research was deplorable, quite frankly. It was so primitive.
That's
so
my question.
So, you know, I thought, God, and we have to print all this, we have to print anything we publish out in uppercase letters? That's ridiculous. You know, all they had were these high speed chain printers, you know, that print the 15 inch wide paper with the perforations on the sides, you know, to feed the paper through these machines at breakneck speeds. And of course, it was just crap. And if they hadn't changed the ribbon, you could, you know, you were bound to get something that could barely be read, you know.
And how, you know, despite those limitations, you were still quite clearly able to see that there was a number of
right.
you know, how were you able to force that, as it were?
Well, here's how. Initially, we were, in fact, it turned out that I was working hot and heavy on trying to find a data input mechanism. This is hardware now we're talking. A data input mechanism which was simply better. That is, that would have upper and lowercase letters from the get-go, and that, in fact, had a very easy way for editing to occur. On the mainframe computers in those days, the typical editor you had was referred to as a line editor, where you'd actually have to imagine this now. You're working with a terminal, not with a CRT terminal, but with some sort of a teletype terminal, you know, printing out this junk at 10 characters per second or whatever it was that they cranked it up to. It wasn't much. And, excuse me, what you had to do was you had to locate the line that you wanted to edit and bring it up, and it would print out. You'd wait for it to print out. And then you'd have to use search and replace algorithms I'm talking about an online editor, online to the mainframe. You had to use search and replace statements to make a change. So you'd have to go find this, change to that. Now imagine having to do that a gazillion times in correcting these transcriptions, which were inputted. And that's another very important point with my research. The need to get a much better method for inputting data, capturing keystrokes, as we used to say. What I decided early on was that I wanted to get away from the key punch as soon as I could. So I used as a pilot, basically, the transcription of the very first manuscript of Alfonso the Wise, which was a very large manuscript. We used the key punch for that. used the key punch, and we managed to produce the entire transcription, all in uppercase, but we were flagging. I decided we're going to flag the uppercase letter with an extra symbol. And so we'll at least be able to convert all those when we get the better technology, which in fact did take place. But there was a disaster that happened because we had something like 15 boxes of key punch cards, the longest boxes that they had in those days. And we were trying to transport them when we had the thing all assembled. I've got to get a drink of water. But anyway, we had them all assembled, and we were transporting them to the computer center. And so we got one of these wheeled carts, and we stacked all these boxes up on this wheeled cart. And we had to wheel it across various intersections in the city to get to the computer center. Well, wouldn't you know it, the darn thing, we tried to get up a curb, and the thing spilled over, and it took us a week to reassemble all the damn cards in the proper order. So we had to do it again. Then I said, we're going to change this thing.
Yeah.
So you tell me if you don't want to hear what I'm going to talk about, because it has all these things are interrelated, the technologies.
This is great. It's
okay. Totally because am I able to yell to my wife to bring me a glass of water? Hold on a second. Ev?
Yes?
Yeah, pode me trazer copo de água. We speak Brazilian Portuguese in this house.
So,
I told you my wife is Brazilian.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was absolutely convinced that there had to be a better way. So I said, what can I do to try to find out what technology is available? So I got this brilliant idea I thought it was brilliant, that I would start going to computer and later information technology, right, IT, but computer-based hardware, not just computers, but in fact, what they used to refer to as peripherals, basically, because you had these mainframe computers, and then you had these peripheral devices that were hooked up to them to do one thing or another, such as what were referred to as monitors, because they weren't really very capable devices. They were basically slave devices hooked to the mainframe. They were terminals. We used to refer to them as terminals. They may still do that. But anyway, I wasn't happy with that. I wanted an offline device because, and this is the other scary thought in this day of dirt cheap, hard Winchester-based technology, hard disks, right? The campus computer facility was charging us, you ready for this? Almost $17,000 a year to rent 20 megabytes of disk storage on their mainframe. $17,000 a year. Yeah. And of course that implied that they had the liability of backing it up and being sure that it was safely stored and on tape copies, typically they would back up on their big eight-track tapes. Anyway, I said, that's ludicrous. So what happened? Long about the time we finished that first key punch card text, the transcription of it, I started going to these computer hardware shows, and I found two different companies. One was they were both startup companies, and I don't know if they even exist any longer, but at the time they were these young geniuses that were working with microcomputer-based devices, where they were incorporating that early microcomputer technology, that Intel, those early Intel chips, the 8080 and subsequently the 8-bit system and then subsequently 16-bit 8086, etc., to make these devices intelligent, programmable devices. So what was the first thing that I found? I found terminals, but they were intelligent terminals that had, now you have to remember, memory circuit chips were very expensive at this time, right? So for micro devices as well. But these particular terminals, quote unquote, intelligent terminals I was looking at, had built-in editing capability, button editing capability. The buttons were actually labeled, insert character, delete character, all that sort of thing, right on the keyboard. And you could do that one 1024 byte page at a time. Okay, it had enough memory to do, in effect, what was more or less equivalent to one page of single space text. But you could hold it then in memory, bring it on the screen, edit it, everything locally. And then I said, well, now we need to transmit it somewhere. I don't want to transmit it directly to the mainframe computer because they're charging me by the second of computer usage, online computer usage, at an outrageous fee. So lo and behold, at the very same hardware show, I found a booth where they were selling what was being sold as a low-cost magnetic tape cartridge. These were digital-grade Philips cassette tapes. You know, Philips, what you still have around, right? The Philips cassette tapes, but a digital grade, and they were dual. It had a dual tape deck, and they were marketing, because it wasn't cheap. It was $5,000 for that particular device, dual tape device. It was $5,000, so it wasn't cheap, but it would beat the hell out. It would be cost effective for us over the long haul to enter our data and edit it offline to the mainframe computer, the UNIVAC. And then, of course, I had to bring pressure to bear on the campus computer moguls there, the ones that ran the campus computer system, to develop software, spooling software that would enable us to spool, when we wanted to, spool the data off of these cassette tapes and in a batch mode into the campus mainframe, into the UNIVAC, for processing. Now I was able to get us off the mainframe computer anyway, but in any case, so this is, I'm trying to be as chronologically correct as possible. What I managed to do was to convince these two companies, since they were small and flexible, the companies, to convince them to interface, to write the code in the case of the CRT, in the case of the intelligent terminal, intelligent monitor people, to output a proper code which would tell the other company's tape drive, Philips tape drive, to open up and receive the data that was being transmitted. That is a page of edited data. And we just concatenate it. Okay? And they did that. They were willing to do it. I don't know how. I think back and I think, geez, today these people would tell me to get out of their site. You know, you ask them to do something, it's going to sell 5 units or whatever it is. But they were anxious enough to be willing to do it. And they did. Now, why did I go to that? Well, there was an alternative device. It was called the IBM Magnetic Tape Selectric Typewriter, the MTST, as it was dubbed by IBM, and in which it interfaced its own very sui generis tape drive. There was nothing else like it. It was IBM, and it was not compatible with anything, obviously, or would ever be compatible with anything, built into this box and connected to an IBM Selectric typewriter. You know, the Selectric with the ball, the little bouncing ball on it. Do you recall? Are you too young to remember that?
I do have an interest to find, at least.
Yes. Well, they were leasing that device for about $15,000 a year. And I needed 5 of them as data entry stations. I had the staff. I had the first pilot grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities at this point. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to hire staff. Now, you have to understand that my data entry problem was nothing like most of the other humanists who were getting started in the field, where they could, many of them actually would send their books that they wanted to have keystroked, captured keystrokes. They'd send them to Hong Kong, and there were these data entry services that would simply sit there and type, you know, have all these people paying them peanuts to bash away the stuff they were seeing on these printed texts. Well, we couldn't do that because you had to be a trained paleographer to be able to read our input. We were working directly with original manuscripts written in the 13th century. So, and subsequent centuries after we did the Alphonsine corpus. So I was fortunate enough, quite frankly, at that time that I was hired after, as I finished my PhD and my dissertation and whatnot, and I graduated, and they decided to keep me on as a professor. So someone jokingly said that the dean kept me on because he knew that I had $250,000 federal grant, and So they wanted to get their 45 cents on the dollar. That wasn't true. I actually asked the dean myself personally, and he laughed and said, no, that wasn't true. That they kept me on because they thought I was worthwhile. I thought that was great.
But the first NEH grant, that was around, what, 1972-ish?
It was. I can't remember the exact date of the inception of it. I remember drafting the proposal in 71. So that's okay. I don't remember the exact date, but I think that may be right. It was might have been granted in 72. You know, it's a lengthy process of passing through the
review. And you were still a PhD student at that point?
No, I had when the grant was actually awarded. And I said I was a grad student when I drafted the proposal, when I wrote the proposal. It was right at that transitional point, and I have to confess, my memory is fuzzy about exactly when that happened, but it was right at that point where I was finishing the PhD and becoming hired as a professor that, in fact, we were notified that the money would be forthcoming. Yeah.
And what was your PhD? Was that a sort of traditional PhD, so to speak, or?
I did use as much of the technology, the computer technology that we had developed up to that point. Now remember, we were now doing data entry using intelligent editing CRTs terminals, right? Mm-hmm. With their own internal editing capability, and interfaced to these as a standalone system, interfaced to these dual tape drive affairs that I referred to as storage media. That duo there, made by two different companies, the intelligent terminal, editing terminal, plus the tape drive unit, replaced what would have been this outrageous rental from IBM for their magnetic tape selector typewriter. But moreover, we didn't have to print out the lines on a selector typewriter at that slow selector typewriter speed when we wanted to edit. You follow? We did all of our editing right on this very fast CRT, and when the page was edited, we pushed a button and it was transferred over to tape two. Pull the unedited version off of tape one on this dual tape drive, transfer the newly edited version to drive B. And then we ended up with an edited version of the data. In any case, that we had available to us when I did my dissertation, which is, in fact, I'll show you many years later. I don't know if you can see it or not. Tell me if you can see that. Can you see that?
Says, oh, yes, I can. The Libro di Marco Polo.
Yeah. My dissertation was, in fact, the editing of, it wasn't even Castilian Spanish. It was the editing of the only manuscript version known to exist, and that's still the case, medieval manuscript version known to exist of a version of the Book of Marco Polo.
Hmm.
And it was translated into Aragonese, 14th century Aragonese. And fortunately, the manuscript itself still exists at the Escorial Library in Spain. And I got a grant to go there, and I actually worked with the original manuscript, a beautiful thing. It's huge. It's about 3 feet tall and open. It's about 2.5 feet wide. And the letters are a good half an inch to three quarters of an inch high in the manuscript. It was all done by hand, of course, on parchment, and all fancy illuminations and miniatures and whatnot in the manuscript. Just beautiful. That really got me going when I was there. I was there at the Escorial for a month working with that. I had done the rough transcription here in Madison from microfilm that I had of the manuscript, and I took it there and actually had to make changes. I'll tell you right now, very often what happens is that there'll be secret little notes or changes that are made in these manuscripts, which are written in the fold of the parchment, and in the binding you can't see it. If you open it up and photograph it, you have to spread the sheets apart to be able to see the notes. And I found many of those where they were actually making corrections to the text in the margin. In any case, I don't know how much of this is of interest to you, but and so it was there that I did apply it to it. Now, how do we get it to print in a beautiful, nice, beautiful typeface, nice, professionally done typeface? Well, I'll tell you what we did. I struck up early on, because the only typesetting that they had, sophisticated typesetting, true typesetting, was in fact commercially available, because the devices, the typesetting devices, were quite expensive. So I struck up a deal with a company that did all of the printing for, I want to say Kmart. It was one of those things. They had a contract. This is an outfit out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that I can remember their name was Color Corp. But they had basically had a subcontractor with one of these big chain stores and to do all of their printing of ads and that kind of stuff, right? And so I said, well, when your machine is fallow, wouldn't you like to make some money? And they said, sure. So the arrangement we had was that typesetting was very cheap. We were able to get professionally done typesetting for probably a third of the cost that it would have been if we had gone specifically to a typesetting service. And these guys were doing it in fallow time. That was the arrangement. You do it when it's convenient for you, and we get the discount. And that's how we did that. So my edition of Marco Polo was done using professional typesetting. Now, I prepared all the data input from this end, and they gave me their typesetting language, their markup language, a copy of the language that they use, and I put the codes in myself to go to, you know, to boldface and whatever, and the point size changes and everything. This all of this stuff Julianne, it's difficult for me to talk about this sequentially because all this stuff is coming in, you know, yeah. Tangentially. The technology I'm talking about is coming in tangentially, and we're looking around and we're grabbing at whatever we figured is going to make it easier for us, you know, and that was available that we could afford. I'm blowing my mind now with this business. All the other stuff, I start thinking of all these other things that come into the play.
If you like, at some point we can also break the interview into two parts.
It's entirely up to you. I don't know how much of this you want to hear and how much is really of marginal interest to you. It's all technology. In fact, the key of this is all of these things that we did to bring in the technology to facilitate the work are germane. Now, much of it, when you look back historically, you say, ha ha, they did that. Well, who cares? You know, that, you know, I remember I wrote an article for Computers and the Humanities, the publication of the Association for Computers and the Humanities. They asked me to write a piece on the project. And at the time, I had just discovered at another one of these hardware shows, I had just discovered a new device that had dual 8-inch floppy disks. Imagine that. And each one of those disks would hold a quarter of a million bytes, which is nothing, right? But you had dual because you could edit then, right? Go from one to the other. And that device actually had a built-in version of the basic programming language. And I remember, and I looked back at this article years ago, but that I wrote, and I thought, what? And I wrote this, you know, and it even has built-in basic programming in this device in firmware. And I put a big exclamation mark, and I had to laugh afterwards, you know, 15 years later. I'm thinking, well, who cares about that? But it's that sort of a thing. When you look back on this early technology, even some of the more sophisticated stuff, obviously it's not as sophisticated as the stuff we have now. So, for instance, that it becomes a historical curiosity, which is, I assume, what you're really all about here in this.
Exactly. And I guess you know some of the sort of what fascinates me is. That when you think especially about, you know, how few humanists were using the computer at that time. Just the ways that people encountered and thought, okay, I can apply this to my research. And just the concept is quite fascinating to me. You know,
right. Well, there were many such eureka moments for me, I'll tell you right now. And a lot of it, most of it, in fact, I would say, came from going to these computer hardware shows. In fact, in 1981, May of 1981, I was chosen. At that point, I took a show on the road for publicity purposes and was asked to give lectures about our work and the technology at a number of camps. I must have gone to 20 different American universities, and I even was invited by the University of Montreal in Canada, and I went there, and I had a sort of a road show. My friends jokingly referred to it Nitty's dog and pony show. And I would actually lug some of this computer equipment that we had put together, which was innovative at the time, and bring it there and show it. how it works. I haven't told you yet about the other little piece of technology that I was able to work into this, and that was optical character recognition at a time when the Kurzweil scanner was very new and cost more than $80,000 a copy, something we couldn't afford. In fact, I discovered at that time there was only one Kurzweil true OCR device in the entire state of Wisconsin. It happened to be here in the city of Madison, and it was owned by a wealthy attorney who would set about to scan retrospectively all of the law statutes for the state of Wisconsin that appeared in the printed books.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked up a deal with him that I could use his Kurzweil, get my staff to go in the graveyard shift when he wasn't using it. So my staff would go there. I hired graduate students to go at night. We trained them on the device, the Kurzweil device, to go to this law firm. And they even gave us the key to go in, let ourselves in and out. And I got my students to scan, because I was already now thinking about how we're going to create a body of word definitions in Spanish for the purposes of the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language, right? It's a different issue, right? We're simultaneously developing software that can bring together all of the lexicon that we're putting together. And in this case, in the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language, was the first phase was the Dictionary of Alphonsine Prose. That's that 13th century corpus. And so what do we do? Well, I figured if we scan what was in the public domain, which was the last edition of the Royal Spanish Academy's Dictionary of the Spanish Language, a monolingual dictionary, right? Spanish with Spanish definitions. If we can scan that dictionary and get it in machine-readable form, then we can modify it to our liking. And it would be our definitional canon, in effect. We could tap, because this thing is while it's a contemporary dictionary of Spanish, it the first editions of it were created in the late 18th century, you know, the century of lights, and so it contained retrospectively huge quantities of the word forms that we were finding in these medieval texts.
Right.
So I said, okay, let's do that. Well, we did manage to get the whole thing scanned, and one of the big shots in the Spanish Royal Academy of Spanish of the Royal Academy of Spanish of the Language, La Real Academia Española de Lengua, was a buddy of mine, a senior professor who was a friend of mine. In fact, I had brought his son, one of his sons, who was a scholar and is still in Spain. Of medieval Spanish. I had brought him here with National Endowment for the Humanities money that I had to help me work on the dictionary of old Spanish we were working on. And his father liked that, obviously. So his father was delighted. When we finished scanning the Royal Spanish Academy's dictionary, it was the 1992 edition of it at the time, we finished scanning that. I sent his father, who was one of the top two people in the academy, I sent his father a copy of the machine-readable text of their dictionary. It's obviously a political stunt, but anyway, it worked. So, you know, they never frowned upon our using that text in creating a definitional database, in effect, out of their dictionary. Obviously, it didn't look anything like their dictionary when we were done with it, it existed only in machine-readable form because that's all we needed to have it exist in, be able to develop a software that would go in and grab the definitions, the appropriate definitions out of the dictionary and pull them into out of their dictionary and pull them into our growing dictionary of Alphonsine prose. I don't know where I've lost my. We might want to try to answer some of these other questions you posed.
The number of things you said are sort of nicely intersecting with actually all of the questions. So what about, did you have some formal training in
computer programming? One of your questions is about programming. No, in fact, what I did was this. I took at the very beginning of all this, when I saw that these programs that existed on the campus mainframe, there were two programs, I didn't mention the other one to you, that they had existing. Both of them were these uppercase only type things, limited by that. Mm-hmm. One was the concordancing program I mentioned to you, and the other was a bibliographic management program, they called it, which was basically enabled you to create bibliographic records and sort them and index them and that kind of thing, okay, which was handy. I mean, I think that was good. In fact, I used it because I had to create, in addition to creating the Dictionary of Old Spanish ourselves, I had to create and establish a canon of the known Old Spanish manuscripts and early printed texts, because we go through with our Old Spanish is considered up until the year 1501.
Okay.
Or beginning of the 16th century. So that's an arbitrary cutoff. But anyway, that's the normal accepted time frame for Old Spanish. That is from the origins, the earliest little scribblings and manuscripts that go back to in some instances, to the 10th century, mostly the 11th century, to see anything with any substance that could be called vernacular, Spanish vernacular. Excuse me. But up to and including the year 1500. So obviously early printed books had already begun, thanks to Gutenberg, had already begun in the last half of the 15th century. So there were a number of texts that we were going to include in the corpus of Old Spanish texts. And the very first I created what we called, the acronym was BOOST, Bibliography of Old Spanish Texts, using the first edition of it. In fact, I found a copy of it here just rummaging around the house. Unfortunately, I can't show it to you because I sent it to John O'Neill, because it's a pristine copy of that very first printed edition of BOOST. So we started there, and of course it was printed out using the yucky chain printers, all in uppercase on the campus mainframe. But the thing started to grow, and it assumed a life of its own, until finally I turned the whole bibliographic arm of the thing over to a very famous professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He just retired. His name is Charles Fallhaber. One of his things was bibliography, and so I turned it over to him, and he's turned it into a completely different thing. But it's huge, and it is the source of material regarding existing manuscripts, medieval manuscripts, and early printed texts in Spanish. Not only in Spanish, but we had expanded it also to include Catalan texts and as well as Portuguese. So we had a bibliography of old Catalan texts and a bibliography of old Portuguese texts. And two of my graduate students who were interested in those two fields took off on those initially. And then we turned that all over to Charles Fallhaber at Berkeley, and he incorporated them all and expanded them no end himself. In any case, his work is called Philo Biblon, and I guess it's still available online. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I've lost track of much of this. In any case, although I saw Charles, he came out and visited me here. He was giving a lecture in not too far from here, in Kalamazoo in Michigan. But anyway, that's how I learned that he is retiring this year, or has retired now this year. The other thing that I didn't really emphasize, I mentioned it, but it must not be lost sight of, is that the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language Project in Wisconsin, as I say, required firsthand knowledge and training of medieval Spanish paleography. You had to know how to be able to read these things, right? Because there are all sorts of abbreviation symbols and stuff, and if you don't know how you're supposed to expand those abbreviations into text, into letters, what good are you? So fortunately, I was teaching at the time, and continued to teach right up until my retirement, courses in Old Spanish paleography. And I had a surprising number of graduate students would enroll in those courses, given the sort of esoteric nature of them, I guess. But it was from those classes, graduate courses in Old Spanish paleography, that I was able to recruit many of my workers, my student help. Because what we would do, we would have to adjust and fiddle with schedules and the like, but many of them want wanted to pick up some extra money in the summer months because they were teaching assistants, let's say, in Spanish at the University of Wisconsin during the school year, but they didn't have any income in the summer. So the NEH grants provided me an opportunity to pay them a salary for the summer months. And everybody made out. And they knew they had already, I could only hire the ones that had taken my course and knew how to do this, you know, knew how to transcribe old Spanish texts from the original forms, photographic reproductions of the original. So that, as I say, it was from the very outset of the project, one of those things that I thought was, is this going to be too much? Is this a daunting task? How can I manage to input, you know, 11 million words of text from the original manuscripts unless I have a small army of people who are trained to do it? But I came up with another solution, which also involves technology, and it has to do with the OCR. The true OCR is the only way we could scan the Royal Academy's dictionary because of the complexity of the typography. But when we're doing transcription of text, that is transcription directly from a photographic reproduction of a medieval manuscript, I thought to myself, well, now there are a number, and I know most of them, a number of professors out there, assistant professors largely were the ones who were hungry and wanted something to do to show they were participating in all this. But there were also some senior people who got involved in it. I found that another one of these computer equipment shows, a standalone scanning device, a textual scanning device, except it wasn't true OCR. And since it wasn't true OCR, it wasn't bothering to read the letters, and therefore it wasn't going to cost $100,000, right? Hmm. It was a device made by a startup company in Miami, Florida. And I struck up, I became friends with the sales rep at the show, and I mean, literally, we became good friends. And he managed to convince his bosses to sell us one of these devices, which list priced for $20,000, to let us buy it for about $10,000. Which was their cost on the device. And so we did. We bought one of these devices, and the promise was that I had to take it in my dog and pony show and show it off as I went to these various campuses and show the technologies we were using. Now, this device incorporated a very interesting thing. You, of course, know the barcodes, the universal barcodes they have now for all products when you go through a grocery store and they scan that stuff. Yeah. This device used, are you ready? It used IBM Selectric typewriter technology, the little ball, the little golf ball, except they manufactured special little golf balls that had under each of the letters a miniaturized barcode. So that when you typed the text would come out above in the alphabetic words. Beneath each of the letters was a miniaturized barcode. That enabled this device, which had an automatic page feeder and everything, right? It enabled this device to scan the sheets, and you could put 100 sheets in the hopper, and it would sit there and scan them, create the digital images of the characters, the underlying ASCII code for the letters. And guess where I managed to convince the company to program the device to be able to transmit it to those those Philips cassette tape recorders that we had interfaced to our at the time and were using to do the editing. So the company that produced this scanning device, I'll call it that because it wasn't true optical character recognition, it wasn't true OCR, it was reading the barcodes, was outputting text, which I was receiving now from my colleagues at various universities who were trained paleographers in their own right, medievalists, Spanish Hispanists who were medievalists and knew how to read old Spanish texts. They would sit at home with their – I would provide them with the typewriter element, the ball, right? They would get their deans to buy them a Selectric typewriter if they didn't happen to have one, you know, which is low tech, really. I mean, it's slick stuff for the time, right?
Yeah.
To see the little bouncing ball there typing. And they would prepare transcriptions. And what did I give them in return for this? The promise that our publishing house, the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies, would in fact publish at least in microfiche form, because we were now creating microfiche as a publication medium, right? Which enabled us to publish thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of information. We are still selling those microfiche packets, and we started selling them from day one, what we call text and concordance combination, a medieval text transcribed and its concordance, printed out on microfiche. We sell them for $10 a piece. In some cases, thousands, 10,000 pages of information for 10 bucks. Because the technology was so cheap that it's for us to produce those microfiche.
Yeah.
It was so cheap that we could afford to sell it for 10 bucks, and we were making probably, I don't know, 75% profit or something. So to feed back into the thing.
Yeah.
To do more.
But how did you, I mean, this is, you know, almost a sort of prototype scholarly crowdsourcing, mm-hmm. or maybe not crowd isn't the right word, but sort of, you know, learned community.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Except that we didn't have prolonged personal contact with these people. There would be long intervals of months, in some cases years, and then suddenly a stack of these especially typewritten, you know, barcode type text would appear on my doorstep for scanning. So I'd go out there myself and I'd feed them into the hopper and dump them off onto Phillips tapes and to these Phillips tapes. And then what we'd do, so that the people working at these remote sites, and remember, they are in fact, most of them, in fact, I think all, I don't recall graduate students at remote universities doing this, but it was basically professors, and the lion's share of them were assistant professors who were looking to get a publication, I guess. Yeah. And that's good. You know, you dangle a carrot and somebody does something for you.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd scan all that stuff, and then what I'd do is I'd print it out. By that time, we now had our own high-speed upper and lower case printing device, which cost us, was it a standalone device, which I interfaced through the tape drive again. And I'd play out these tapes on this printer, and I'd mail back to the individual who had submitted the type pages. I'd mail back this printed copy of what got scanned, and then it was their responsibility to go through and mark up those pages, the printed pages that I sent back to them, printed meaning printed out of this printing device, right? They had to go through and scan the pages and mark them up for errors of theirs and for any possible scanning errors, to correct them. And then they'd send them back to us, you know, with these red marks on them. And then I had my grad student staff sit down and interactively, using the devices I told you about, the intelligent CRT terminal interface to the tapes, to the tape drives, would make the corrections for the transcription.
Can you just reflect for a moment on, and then I'll go back to the questions because I don't want to.
Okay. I wanted to know that I haven't actually gotten you to the really fun part in the use of technology on the project. But I actually started building, because I never finished the question you asked me about had I studied computer programming. I took a course in BASIC, and I said to myself, this is silly. I'm going to try to get money from the government or wherever I can get it from. And in fact, Lloyd Kasten put up some seed money of his own out of his own pocket to hire our first computer programmers. By the way, all of my salaried programmers for the entire duration of this project, some nearly 20 years, were women. And I'll tell you why. Because I discovered that the young male computer programmers did not possess one quality. Many of them were brilliant and excellent programmers, but that quality was constancy. Hmm. I knew that with these gals, and I hired females from age, they went from age 22 to age 56 as computer programmers in the course for this project, during the course of this project. I knew that with the gals that they would be, that they were there today and I could count on them being there tomorrow. And when you're developing complicated computer software, because I haven't even talked to you at all about the programming that we did, the ad hoc programming we developed, not only to create a dictionary from what we come to refer to as citation slips. We modeled this thing in broad terms after the Oxford English Dictionary. Yeah. So that our dictionary has, for instance, it has dated citations, snippets of text out of the manuscript with the date of the manuscript associated with the snippet. So in that sense, it's not only a period dictionary, medieval, but it's historical within that period. And that was all done through the program that we developed ourselves, the ad hoc program. In any case, go ahead, Nob. I'm sorry, I probably made you forget what you were going to ask.
I was just going to ask about the Yeah, if you could just reflect on, you know, how it was. So you developed a whole sort of intellectual and technical and social infrastructure quite clearly supporting the whole project. And so can you just reflect on those sort of moments where you were able to put these different bits of technology coming from different places?
Sure.
And just, you know, the sort of inspiration, I mean, so for example, the way, you know, you mentioned OED, so there was, you know,
right,
almost crowdsourcing with OED, with
well, not really. I mean, I used it because I had copies of OED in my own copy for some time, and I was always impressed with it. I still think it's the best dictionary there is. But anyway, I have been impressed with it from the very outset, and I remember having read and seen stories about how the confection of the OED came about and whatnot, the idea that they actually had a bunch of non-technical people sitting around and writing, they found a word or they saw it, they called them readers. The OED people, the lexicographers, called these people readers. And their job was to read text and pull out words that they thought were neat and hadn't yet been documented or whatever. And then they had to write them on snippets of paper. I remember at one point OED staff was receiving basically little pieces of paper, scraps of paper, napkins or whatever the people were writing on with these entries, shall we say. And that intrigued me. I liked that idea. And that's what I said, well, let's see. Now we can do that and go one step further. We can capture their keystrokes instead of having them send us a bunch of snippets of paper, right? We can actually have them send us machine readable pieces of paper, 8.5 by 11 sheets, right? And that's when I brought in the tech. That's what inspired me, that the analog in a technologically more sophisticated, and facilitating, shall we say, facilitating manner of submission of new entries and that sort of thing. In this case, it was textual, new texts being incorporated into the corpus of text that we were building, of medieval Spanish texts. So
I know now this is probably a very difficult question, but you know, how did you find that? So that whole process of you designing this, of you sort of, you know, conceptualizing and implementing this whole infrastructure that you built around it.
Right.
So was it, you know, can you just reflect on that process a bit more?
Well, it started out sort of helter-skelter. I was learning as I went along, basically. That's why I told you my circumstance, and this is going to sound terribly immodest. I don't mean it to be. It just happens to be true. My circumstances in doing what I sought to do, which was a dynamic. It wasn't static. I didn't from day one say, let's see. I can see that computers can produce a concordance from this, albeit primitive looking. they have that capability. I didn't say that. Let's see. I said, what do I really want to do? Is there computer technology available, both hardware and software, that can do what I really want to do, my dream world? What's my dream world? And so I was driven, and I think that's the proper word here. I was driven by this notion that there has to be a better way. So every time in the process of integrating all these things, people and equipment, I felt as though it could be done a better way, whatever the particular aspect of it was I was dealing with. I would set about to try to see if there was a different, better, and improved way to do it.
Mm.
And, of course, I was fortunate that during the course of this 20-odd year odyssey, technology itself was not static, obviously. So there were new devices being come on the market. There were even new software packages. So, for instance, I haven't told you yet, but the software that we wrote, I should have gone back, because mixed in all this stuff was John Nitti assembling PCs before there were PCs. There were kit computers that were coming out of California, these sort of garage-built kit computers. They send you the components. The first one I built was a little 8-bit Intel 8080 chip. It was a thing, and it started with 64K of RAM, which cost a lot of money. And it came in what looked like a mahogany window box, something you plant flowers in, right? It was about almost a yard across, a wide, and quite narrow, because at the end of it, you had two of these 8-inch floppy disks. Those are the days where the floppy disk was, in fact, reflective of its physical quality. It actually did flop. It was a flexible the flexible disc. And by extension, many people refer to the little 4-inch ones as floppies, even though they're solid, they don't flop. Anyway, that was the technology then. And I built the damn kit computer, and I actually started to try to offload some of the sorting stuff that we did, the sorting procedures that we did, and organizing words. I offloaded it, believe it or not. It was a pain in the tail because of the storage capacity was limited to these two quarter of a million byte floppy disks. But one floppy disk you'd stick in there with text, and you'd sort the stuff you wanted to sort, and it would write the output to the output the other. We developed our own little sort algorithm to run on that little microcomputer. These were the early microcomputers. This is before IBM PCs and TRS-80s and that sort of thing. That was my favorite little thing. I should have kept that. I didn't keep it. I mean, as the technology went on. But then I connected with an outfit in California, another outfit in California, that was using as an operating system. I don't know. You're too young to remember the battle between the two big micro operating systems, the CPM and DOS, MS DOS. Gates made Gates a multi-billionaire, right? Why? Gates was very lucky because when IBM was planning to release its 16-bit PC, they were looking for an operating system. They chose Bill Gates' MS-DOS for that operating system. And as a result of that, everything was modeled after that operating system since. And then Gates, of course, the Microsoft Corporation, then started producing subsequent iterations of that, plus Windows and what have you, right? It came from that. Now, you know now, they're still producing iterations of Windows. Mm-hmm. Windows 8, I guess, is the latest. In any case, what happened was, in the early days, one of the more sophisticated microcomputer companies that sold components, actually, you bought the components and you had to integrate the computer yourself, build it yourself, had chosen, because there was no multi-user operating system, a true multi-user, multitasking operating system for microcomputers. In fact, the MS-DOS notion and IBM then went to basically networks, right? So you would network a series of different PCs attached to some central PC, right? Well, I built during all of this, and we used it for years. I built an 8-user multi-user system, a true multi-user system where there were terminals. These were just dumb terminals interfaced to this computer. And it could run, it was running the multi-user version of CPM, which was called MPM. Now people say, what? What's that? Most people don't even know what that is because it didn't happen to be chosen by IBM as their favorite operating system. Bill Gates' system did. So in any case, that we used that as a subsequent data editing station. I had eight and data entry. I had eight students simultaneously entering data to the what kind of a hard disk device? Early Winchester technology. I concatenated four. Are you ready for this? 480 megabyte. That was a lot then. A megabyte, an 80 megabyte drive. A Winchester technology disk, and it was about that high and about that wide. Each one. I concatenated four of those together in one enclosure and interfaced it to this multi-user computer. So we actually had a sizable chunk of hard disk. Remember, I was no longer paying the $17,000 a year to the campus mainframe people for 20 megabytes of hard disk.
Hmm.
Anyway, ask me what you want to ask.
Okay, incredible. Just before I, you just mentioned that you had your vision, as it were, your perfect world,
Right.
It just occurred to me that I didn't actually ask you to describe that.
Well, my perfect world was also a dynamic because I went about it in the following way. I said, okay, there are particular tasks that this project of ours needs to be able to do, using computer technology and related technologies. They included, of course, something that I mentioned to you about the typesetting, computer-based typesetting. Well, I went with that and had the subcontract early on with this company I told you about that provided typesetting services and on off hours. We got a discount. But I wasn't content with that. I wanted to be able to do our own typesetting in-house. And now we finally had, we finally had some sophisticated output printing devices coming on the market that in fact could do. Now, of course, you laugh and you say, hell, I can, for $50, and in fact, I did buy recently a Lexmark all-in-one multi-purpose printer for $50, which is as much as the inkjet cartridges for it cost. But anyway, and of course, it can produce good typographical quality stuff. Not necessarily the finest typographical stuff, but certainly suitable for reproducing and publishing in books. So we then went to, how are we going to be able to do the typography ourselves on a personal computer? I'll call it that, on a microcomputer. Well, it turned out that this fellow Donald Knuth, who had invented and wrote for Unix mainframes, the Tech typesetting language, T-E-X, but it's pronounced Tech after the Greek. A typesetting language, he turned it over to public domain. He said, I don't want to make money off of this. I'd like to spread the good news. So as soon as it got turned over to public domain, little companies started producing, in this case, early on, DOS-based, MS-DOS-based versions of Tech for $200. I bought the complete typesetting capability with more sophistication than I ever imagined to use, because it could also typeset sophisticated mathematical formula and that sort of thing. It was so sophisticated. In fact, Knuth had designed it for that purpose originally. So then I said, now we've got the core software, and we actually bought the source code of that package. You could buy it with or without the source code. So we bought it with the source code, meaning my programmers now, the ladies I was referring to earlier, could in fact develop, interface with that typesetting language in such a way as we could create our own output in electronic form, typeset pages, including the changing of the running heads and with the alternating pagination and the running head changes, because we were controlling the software itself, the typesetting software. We were sticking our noses into that typesetting software and saying, this is what we want you to do, damn it. And it did it. And in fact, I don't know if you probably don't have a copy of the Dictionary of the Old Spanish Language, the Dictionary of Alphonsine Prose. Here, I don't know if you'll be able to see this. My wife dug it up and put it up on the shelf there saying, you show her this.
Yeah.
It's this, I don't know, can you see it?
Oh, wow. Wonderful.
Yeah, this is the Dictionary of Alphonsine Prose, and I told you about. And I typeset all of this right here at home, the entire dictionary.
Whoa.
I printed it out on a low-cost laser printer. It was a laser, not an inkjet, but still sophisticated printer that only cost us about $1,000. Mm-hmm. And I printed the whole thing out here, and at this point, I had already transferred. When I finished this dictionary in 2002 and printed the final copy out, I had already transferred the Hispanic Seminary, the publishing house. Notice the seal there, the gold seal. Can you see it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I had already transferred the thing to New York to my Irishman there, John O'Neill, right? And so that's why it says New York, 2002. I sent him the camera-ready copy. All these pages that I printed out, he negotiated as he was doing. He negotiated a contract with a printing outfit, and and that's how it came to be. And we had the dictionary, and we were able to sell this. O'Neill was able to sell this when we first started out. I have to confess, I don't know what he's selling it for now, but whatever little copies, few copies are left. We were selling it for $150. $150 for three of these volumes. Imagine that. What would you think you'd have to pay for it? Let me see. I can't even, my memory doesn't serve me. It's almost 2,000 pages long of these oversized pages. And oversized double column pages. Let me show you. There.
Well,
you see that. Anyway,
my special area, one of my main research areas is the history of dictionaries, the history of lexicography.
Well, I think as a result of all this, whether correctly or not, I guess I got the reputation of doing what I did best and knowing what I was doing. And so the endowment, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Helen and I used to go on site visits a lot. We'd meet. They say, we're going to Yale this time, and we'd convene there for a site visit of a project that was wanting to employ computer technology, humanistic project, actually, research tools project, which was Helen's area. And we had great fun. Not all the principal investigators at these universities, particularly ones, the stuffy Ivy League schools, weren't necessarily very happy to get my advice, but they got it anyway.
So this brings us back to, maybe brings us back to question 5, which is about scholars who were not using computers and their research, the sense you might have of what their views on humanities computing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you made the link. It is a good one. Basically, I have to start out by saying my mentor, Lloyd Kasten, I mentioned him to you, died at age 94. He was helping me with this dictionary, doing the final corrections of the last proof of this dictionary of Alfonso, 3 months before his death, up to 3 months before his death. He was still working with me on a daily basis, the two of us sitting side by side, me at the computer terminal, and he was working through, pouring through the pages, and we were finding whatever we needed to change, and I would effect the change and go on to the next page. Lloyd Kasten was an incredible fellow. He didn't know anything about computer technology, nothing, zero. He knew less than I knew in the beginning. But the moment I started, and the experimentation, I have to say, that I was able to do was thanks to Lloyd Kasten, because he was bankrolling me for a time there, particularly before we got any of the federal funding. Yeah, we had the largest funding we got was from the endowment, but we also got $300,000 worth of matching money from the Spanish government.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I was, in fact, named as a visiting Fulbright scholar to the University of Salamanca, which is important for this purpose, not because of me, but because I went there after we had developed all of the microcomputer-based software to create this dictionary and actually typeset it. I installed all of the software gratis on the computers of my colleagues in medieval Spanish at the University of Salamanca, which is one of the oldest universities in Europe. And they, with the software, after I taught them, I was there for 3 months as a Fulbright visiting scholar, and I taught them how to use the stuff, and they were three ladies. And I jokingly referred to them as mis tres Marias, my three Marys, because they all, particularly the Catholic ones, the Catholic ladies all start with Mary somebody or other, right? So, but we had a heck of a good time there, and I taught them all how to use the stuff, and they, in their own right, created two separate dictionaries, big monstrous dictionaries, the more important of the two being a dictionary of medieval Spanish medical texts.
Ooh.
They actually got all the hands on, and they were, of course, in Spain, so they were in an ideal location to gain access to the manuscript. But I forgot where I was going with that, but anyway. The people who didn't use computers. Well, that's another case. These three ladies had never looked at a computer in the eye, really. I mean, they had just started their campus. It was bringing in PCs for the offices and whatnot, so they probably were, writing letters or something. But they got into this with both feet. As a matter of fact, they beat us in terms of the chronology of the publication of their medical dictionary. It actually came out before ours did. They were able to finish it. I did all across the final typesetting and everything here again in my house. I typeset that dictionary, and they paid for having a courier deliver the typeset pages to them to take them to Salamanca. So I had two experiences basically that with the older people you'd expect older in this case scholars researchers professors you might expect some resistance I guess that's why you raised that question. You wanted to know was there resistance from these older people to all these new techniques, and I must love this thing. And the answer is yes and no. The people here I had at the University of Wisconsin, the older people, were delighted, with the stuff. And Mr. Kasten, as soon as I was now using PC-based technology, Mr. Kasten said, buy me one of those things. He gave me the money. He says, buy me one of those things, and I want to take it to my house. So he was, by the way, a fantastic typist. He could type. Incredible and amazing. Even as an old man, he could bang out stuff on type. I'm talking about conventional, manual typewriters. So I got one for him and set him down in it, taught him how to use a word processor and all that stuff. And he was actually typing in his bibliography, his own library collection, actually typing in entries. Mm. So it was a delight to see him. There was absolutely no hesitation or no griping about this technology, nothing. Another one I think you'll get a kick out of, which is very important, is a fellow by the name of Frederick Cassidy. Fred Cassidy, who was Kasten's contemporary and died in his 90s also, was the creator, the founder, and the editor of the Dictionary of regional English, American English, Dictionary of Regional American English. And I was talking to him. He had me, because I was obviously a known lexicographer on campus at that point, and so he invited me to serve on that dictionary's board of advisors. It wasn't that we met all the time, but it was more of a figurehead type thing. But when I showed him what we were doing, with the computers, in terms of data entry in particular. You remember I'd mentioned to you the intelligent terminals and the tape drives that we interfaced at that point? He said, I want those. So he incorporated that same technology, and oddly enough, one of my female computer programmers then went to work for him programming for the Dictionary of American Regional English as well, because she was on top of everything we had been doing. Whereas his dictionary is considerably different in its nature and scope, obviously. So there wasn't any software transfer, but the hardware, of course, was, you needed to be able to enter these great gobs of data somehow, capture the keystrokes instead of being fleeced by the campus computing facility, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the online services. There were probably, God, I couldn't even put a number on it. During my meanderings through, because I then started to give these lectures at various universities, and I would meet people afterwards. They'd come up to talk, and there were some instances of people who were humanists, and I don't think it was an age proposition, quite frankly, although not the youngest ones. The youngest ones were on board from the get-go. They saw it was not only the future, it was the present, so they wanted to know. What happened was, for a while, there. I don't know if you're familiar with this. I got to get my thoughts together here. I made some notes. Oh yeah, there's an internet. It's called the International Congress on Medieval Studies, and it's held annually in Michigan at Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's the biggie, really.
Yeah.
Of international medieval studies, and so I don't know how, but the guy who used to run it at that time, he's now been dead for a long time. Got a hold of my number or something, and he called me and said, "Wouldn't you like to have an ongoing session of computers?" And in the humanities, he said, here at the Kalamazoo Conference every year. And I said, I suppose so. And so I signed up for that. And I did it for about 5 years. And I was told, I don't know if this is true or not, I was told that it was the most heavily attended session at the conference. which seems a bit much, but you could see it spanned all the fields. So, you know, somebody who wasn't interested in Chaucer or Alfonso the Wise, but would be interested in technology. And it went on until the fifth year, when basically we now had PCs hitting the market, you know, the Apples and the TRS-80s and that sort of thing. And it became, I sort of got this sinking feeling that people were attending it, many of them were attending it, not because they were interested in learning anything, but because they wanted me to confirm that they had made the right choice in buying their PC. You know, it got to be brand specific, shall we say. You know, I bought it, and it's great, and that was that type of thing. So I figured this session has outlived its usefulness now. So I begged out
When was that, roughly? I suppose if I check the proceedings, I'll be able to figure it out anyway.
Yeah, remember, I'm an old guy, so I can't remember all these dates. I'm doing my damnedest.
Don't worry, I'll be able to figure that one out myself.
Okay. In fact, I have to tell you that I went online myself in anticipation of this. I said, I know she's going to ask me when this happened. So I went online myself and tried to find retrospective publication of minutes or whatever, or programs or whatever, to see when it was I did it. But anyway, I don't remember exactly. Although there was another thing that I now remember. I found this little card right here, which was, I was told, it says John Nitti, Professor, University of Wisconsin, etc. And it is an admission card to the 1981 National Computer Conference, which is the big conference for computer types, not for humanists, but for computer types. And this was May of 1981. It was being held in Chicago. And I was invited to present what I was told was the first talk offered by a humanist ever at the National Computer Conference. I don't know. Can't swear to that. That's what I was told by the people who invited me to do it. So you have
what
to take
kind of
that.
I presume you got a...
I would present. I would give a presentation. And what excited these people, I think, was the fact that I was incorporating all sorts of different computational hardware.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because then it integrates the whole thing, and it was an application to see how this stuff, this technology, in particular the hardware, could be applied to humanistic research. And so the for instance was my project, and it was well attended. I thought, I was surprised. I figured there'd be four or five people sitting there, you know, out of thousands who frequented this place. You know who the hell cares about this? Particularly among computer types, don't you see?
Okay, so I'm just so we're coming up to about 2 hours, so
you control the show now, Julianne. I will try to keep quiet until you say speak.
I'm just going to ask probably two more questions and we'll finish up then, because I don't want to sort of, you know, completely.
I assume you're going to take liberties to edit out all of this, any nonsensical thing that I may have pronounced during the course of this. You'll do me that favor, won't you? I grant you editing rights.
Well, how it works is I have some students who'll do a transcript, and then I'll iterate back and forth with you on the transcript till we're both happy with it.
Okay.
And at that point.
All right. Yeah, because I mean, some of my banter you probably won't want to have propagated to posterity.
I mean, to be honest, I did, you know, I do as little editing as possible, because what I find is that it's amazing the way different people, you know, what you may think is banter is actually quite valuable to somebody else.
Well, I hope that you don't look upon this as the product of a disordered mind, although my mind is more disordered now than it was 20 years ago, I have to confess. But it's just that. To bring in all the aspects of the stuff, I can't give you a nice, neat chronological unfolding, because there are things, you know what I mean?
And that's not necessarily what I'm looking for either, you know. When I research this, I'll be looking for themes. Well, it's themes that various themes that interest me. And so really, the chronological thing is, I don't worry about that so much. So the last two questions. So the first is, you had already anticipated the issue of resistance. So did you encounter any significant resistance?
You know, I the only resist, again, I'm a very pragmatic person, so, and stubborn as hell. So I went into the thing saying, I know what the devil I want to do, you know, and so the only thing that's going to impede me from doing this is money. You know, the moment the money valve is shut, then I say, I can't do anything more. I'm not independently wealthy, so I obviously couldn't do it myself. Fortunately, I had that angel in Lloyd Caston who was willing to put up tens of thousands of dollars, I have to tell you. And it was, in his case, you had to understand, an elderly man already, and was working up until his 94th birthday on this dictionary with me. So you have to keep that in mind. He was at times giddy like a kid when I introduce a new guy. I say, I want this gizmo. There's stuff I haven't even told you about, the gizmos I haven't told you about. I interfaced another gizmo. I interfaced it into all this stuff was a product that was made to order, apparently for the United States Patent Office. It was a microfiche. This was the time when we were doing microfiche output. It was a microfiche, computer-driven microfiche retrieval and display unit that could hold, had a carousel in there, and you could load it up with microfiche. And you could each microfiche had, and each frame had its own address. So you could build an address table for everything that was in there. And we would bring up, in 1 second, we could bring up a photographic color reproduction of a manuscript page that corresponded to a page of transcription that we had just done to do final checking against the original manuscript. Anyway, yeah. But I've forgotten now where we were going with that. Correct. Get me back on track.
You were saying that he would be giddy with excitement.
Oh, yeah. He'd see, and I'd say, I want this machine. And he said, well, what does it do? And I'd explain it to him. And he said, okay, how much do you need? And I'd say, $10,000. And he said, okay. He'd write me a check. So, I mean, and that was – so what it meant was – it meant something very important, because with National Endowment for Humanities funding, you have to have pre-budgeted everything. You have to have justified the purchase and whatever – of everything. So if there was a new gizmo that came down the pike and I liked it and wanted it, thought there was a place for it in the project, and fortunately there was, and every time I did that, I had that epiphany about a particular new gizmo. I couldn't go and rob the NEH grant that I had, because everything had already been allocated. Mm-hmm. So I'd go to Lloyd Caston, you know, and he'd provide me with the money to do it. So I had great fun, as a matter of fact, doing all, as you can well imagine, as a kid playing with toys. Well, have we covered the stuff that you need?
So this is the very last question.
Okay.
That I just want to ask is just, I think you've already mentioned sort of a couple of things relevant to this, but just your sort of encounters with the humanities computing community, your conference scene, and
There, it's funny, because when the whole thing started, I was a handful of pioneers. I hate to use the word, sounds self-serving, but other people use that in my connection. So, and in fact, what instead of having existing bodies of groups that met on a consistent basis that I could go to, I was throwing parties, as it were, for principal investigators in projects that were purporting to use or were using computer technology. And they would come to Madison. They'd come here. They'd come up to the Seminary of Medieval Studies where I hung out. And we basically owned 3/4 of the 11th floor of this tower building. And we paid for every square foot, by the way. The dean kept reminding me in their indirect costs that they would rake off the top of the NEH fund. But I think we had at least three. And there was basically, they were not terribly formal. I just contacted you. Why don't you come here? We'll brainstorm. Come to Madison. We'll, you know, and I'll arrange for your hotel room. And so I would get maybe six, at the most seven, principal investigators in various projects around the country would come. They came from as far away as California in the country. There really wasn't. And when I finally got everything established, so I knew exactly where I was going with the project, this is going to sound terribly supercilious on my part. I don't mean it to be. I didn't really feel the need. I was going, let's put it this way. My need to communicate to other people was being gratified by being invited to various universities to talk about the project. And then the fun part was not me giving the talk. The fun part was after the fact, I'd hang around and people would come up, you know, in great droves and have all sorts of interesting questions to put to me. And that was fun.
Hmm.
I don't know if I answered them all successfully, but it was fun. So I don't there again, apart from a group, in fact, there was a sort of a cliquish group of us. Perhaps that's not the right word. There was a group of us of principal investigators who were asked, this is in the early days of the National Endowment's first National Endowment of Humanities, first willingness to offer funds for compute, for incorporating computer technology into humanistic research. This is the research tool division, again, Helen's division. And they, that group of guys, it was all guys at that point, the endowment asked us to, and I think there were five of us, if my memory serves me, to draft the first rules, the first expectation of rules, guidelines for principal investigators in the humanities seeking to incorporate computer technology into their research.
Helen even sent me this, I think.
Did she?
Yeah.
I never kept a copy of what we did. Obviously, it's been redone, I don't know how many times, countless times, I'm sure, in the interim. But and it was that group of guys. We actually had the endowment then. Remember I was talking about getting our feet wet on typesetting, using computer typesetting? Well, the NEH sponsored a workshop, I guess it was called, at the University of South Carolina. And there were, I think there were five of us, four or five of us who were principal investigators in our own right. And one of them was a guy at South Carolina in English. And they sponsored this workshop to draw, and there were a good number of people, and the technical people from the major university presses in the United States, the publication outlets of the university presses, to go there to learn how to hands-on typesetting. And we had stuff, and this was still pretty primitive, but we had kludged up stuff, you know, typesetting languages for them to work with, ones that we did, and they actually had to go through a process of inputting data and then inputting the markup language into the data and then sending it to the typesetting device that they had at South Carolina, printing it out, and they got to see. You know, that was a big thrill for these people. You can imagine. I mean, it would have been a big thrill for me if I had done it 15 years earlier, you know.
Yeah.
To be able to see, hey, we don't have to necessarily farm out the typography to a commercial. You're going to pay a lot of money in those days. You're paying a lot of money to typeset a page. So, I mean, we're talking about sophisticated typography in terms of the quality, the high density typography on clay coated stock. Anyway, I'm sorry. I guess I warned you. You're going to be dealing with an eccentric old man, and I guess I made that. I tried to conceal it, but I'm sure I failed.
Well, I think, as I said, the more eccentric, the better in this project. Thank you so much. I think this is just really fascinating and really, really valuable.
Well, you flatter me in saying that, but I appreciate it. It helps. Since I've been out of the business so long, I don't report to have maintained my familiarity with the technology, even some of it I have, because I'm just interested in it myself.
It's fantastic. So sort of how we'll go from here is, so as I said, I'm sort of in between grants, but you know, but I still have people to do the transcription. So it will be a few months before the transcription's finished.
Oh, don't worry about that. I've been waiting for years and years and years, and I can wait. I hope I can wait a few more. I say that jokingly, but not completely, because I'm pacemaker dependent, and I was just thinking, she better get this interview in quick, because I've had this pacemaker in my chest for 11 years, and when they put it in there, they said, that ought to last you 7 years. I said, 7 years, eh? This December, it'll be 11 years, not seven, that it's in my chest. So it's looking as though they have to replace it when the battery gets low, right? So it's amazing when you think about that, just that technology, the fact that there's a little battery that's been keeping me alive for 11 years.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. So, and again, the battery life expectancy was only 7 years, they said. So that's an average number, obviously. But
yeah, I know. Okay, so we'll, and then hopefully, as I said, I mentioned, hopefully this book with Springer will come off.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and it was fun working with you in this part of it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I hope it was what you wanted and not too far.
No, it's fantastic. I think it's actually the best interview I've had so far. Okay, so I'll be back in touch soon, basically, with the transcription, and we'll go from there. And if there's anything that occurs to you or anything you want to ask me or whatever, just don't hesitate to get in contact.
Well, the only thing that I ask is that in transcribing that you tell your people to eliminate any obscenities that may have come out of my mouth during the course of the interview.
Okay.
The people who know me well would expect that, but you see, this is going to be general fodder for the masses. So
yeah,
you want people going away after reading it and saying, "What the hell did she interview that old crank for?"
No.
All right, Julianne, thank you.
Okay, take care and thanks again.
Bye bye.